If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Welcome back to Gotta Gotcha here on Reality Check Radio with Marie. Joining me now all the way from Buenos Aires is Doug Casey, best-selling author, world-renowned speculator and libertarian philosopher. You'll find him on his YouTube channel, Doug Casey's Takes, and very, very popular newsletter as well, plus many other shows. But Doug, it is such a joy to have you here. Many people know you as Doug Casey, International Man, which is what my husband refers to you in this house. It's never just Doug Casey, it's Doug Casey, International Man. So it's so good to have you here. So welcome back to New Zealand. You lived here for quite some time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back to New Zealand, even if only electronically at this point. And I lived in New Zealand from about 1998 to about 2010, something like that. I was a landed immigrant. I came there for the polo, actually, but stayed because I just liked New Zealand. Anyway, yeah.
Yeah, and that whole area out in East Auckland is lovely. It's really beautiful out there. So one of the show is about culture primarily, and we talk about sort of the culture wars, how Western culture and Enlightenment values are under attack by ideologues. How does that manifest itself in a financial space?
Well, very badly, because Western civilization itself is under attack, and Western civilization is, it's very fashionable among the so-called elite. They call themselves elite, but in essence, most of them are really just parasites. And they're anti-freedom. They're actually anti-people. And if Western civilization is washed away, eventually all of the good things in the world we have are going to be washed away. Listen, I'm fine with Indian civilization and Chinese civilization and all the rest of this. That's fine. I mean, I like yoga. I like General Chow's chicken. But all of the good things that we get in the world come from the West. All of the technology, the concepts of freedom. So it's under attack today, and I'm rather shocked by that fact.
Mm. So then how do you financially galvanize yourself from those attacks?
It's becoming harder and harder to be an investor. An investor, we ought to define our words, because one thing that is not done well today is people use words in very loose ways so that you don't really know what they're talking about. When I say an investor, I mean somebody who allocates capital in a way that's going to create more capital, that's going to increase the standard of living, increase the amount of real wealth in the world. That's becoming harder and harder in today's world, because the state, which is a terrible thing, the institution itself is corrupt and dangerous and basically evil, has grown tremendously over the last century. They've gone from taking 5, maybe 10% of the production of the bailiwick that they rule to 50% or more in most Western countries. So it's hard to be an investor where they take half of what you earn. The regulations are just as damaging as the taxes, telling you what you can do, can't do, prices you can sell things at, all kinds of terrible things. And the last is inflation of the currency. It makes it very hard for the average person to build capital when, if he produces more than he consumes and saves the difference, he puts it into a depreciating fiat currency. So what I'm saying is, I guess your question, Marie, is how do you invest in order to stay ahead of the game? And those three things make it very hard: taxation, regulation, and inflation. So what do you do to keep your head above financial water? And at this point, my answer is you really have to learn to be a speculator. And most people don't understand what that means either. ideally, a speculator is somebody who capitalizes on distortions in the marketplace caused by government intervention. If we lived in a free market society, which would be much more prosperous than one we currently live in, you couldn't be a speculator. But in today's world, you're almost forced to be a speculator to try to second guess what the bureaucrats and government are going to do. But it can be a profitable occupation to see stupid things that the government's doing and, in effect, bet against it. Mm. So that's my philosophy of investment in the short run.
Mm. Well, I know that in the period of time that you lived in New Zealand, that residential housing sales, which is New Zealand's favourite form of investment, was at an all-time low after the turn of the century. And then by 2008, 2010, with the global financial crisis, it had gone through a full cycle, a full bubble. And then that bubble got even bigger again on the sort of slope outside of the global financial crisis. And that has become a political hot potato amongst governments on how to cool the New Zealand residential housing market. And of course, they have issues with supply because they're unable to supply because they make it so regulatory and difficult to build houses and access land to build houses and infrastructure to build houses that they in themselves are part of the problem. And then they're asked to actually, you know, so they set the fire and then they're called upon to put the fire out. If you're someone in New Zealand who's very wedded to land and buildings, would that be that form of speculation, or do they need to be looking elsewhere?
Well, putting your money in a house, first of all, is a house an investment? And technically speaking, it's not. It's a consumer good. I mean, you've got very short-lived consumer goods like toothbrushes. You've got longer-lived consumer goods like a set of clothes. You've got longer-lived consumer goods like automobiles and cars. Houses are just like cars. They're just a longer-lived consumer good. They don't produce new wealth, is what I'm saying. So people that are buying houses should consider them as a speculative vehicle. Now, that's very perverse because it's a consumer good that should be used. But this is what happens in a highly regulated, highly taxed, inflated society. You've got to hide. You've got to put your money in something that's real, something that's substantial, that won't be destroyed by inflation. So, yeah, it's an artificial bubble when that happens to housing. And it's happening many places in the world, not just New Zealand at this point. So the answer to the question is, should you buy a house? Well, like I said, it's not an investment, it's a consumer good. But it's a very expensive consumer good right now. And the trouble with houses is that they float on a sea of debt. In the U.S. and Canada, certainly, and I believe I'm still correct when I say this in New Zealand, nobody buys or can sell a house without a mortgage, without financing. I believe I'm correct in New Zealand. Yeah. That makes it very leveraged and very dangerous, because if it's not a cash market, it's a leveraged market built on debt. And with all the debt in the world, we could have a credit collapse. I don't know. Look, houses aren't an investment. That's what I'm trying to say. They're a speculative vehicle that have consumer characteristics. Mm. Marie, I say that as somebody that when I lived in New Zealand, real estate was very, very good to me. But when I moved to New Zealand in 1998, I think the Kiwi dollar was something like 35 cents US, and the economy was flat on its back. Mm. So property in New Zealand was an excellent speculation from my point of view, but things are different today.
Yeah, I fully understand that. I mean, I bought my first house in 1999 when I was, you know, still in my mid-20s, which today, if you talk to anybody in their mid-20s, they wouldn't even dream of consider buying a house because they're priced out of the market, yeah.
It's the same in the US and Canada, of course, too.
So then you look old world, new world. So when I say old world, new world, gold versus Bitcoin, they're both just as relevant. Well, the gold especially is just as relevant now as it's ever been. What are some of the things to consider when you're looking, say, back to something as tangible as gold versus something that is new and intangible for many as Bitcoin?
Well, I was a late adopter to Bitcoin. I only got into it in 2017. I've been in gold for many, many years. Gold has been very good to me. The thing with gold is people treat it like a speculative vehicle at the current price where it is now, close to 2,200 US in that area. But you should consider gold as a savings vehicle, a place where you can set aside capital, something real that will be in your hand, that will stay there. It won't vanish with inflation. I was late to the Bitcoin party because I considered the five elements of a good currency and analyzed Bitcoin in that light. A good currency has to be durable. That's why you don't use wheat, for instance, as currency, because it can rot. It doesn't last forever. It has to be divisible. That's why you don't use artwork, for instance, as currency, because you can't make change for the Mona Lisa. It has to be convenient. That's why you don't use lead as money. It takes too much to be of value. It has to be consistent. That's why you don't use diamonds or real estate as money, because they have value, but they're all different from each other. And the last thing is it has to have use value. So you can't get stuck holding the bag with something that has no use value. And that was the problem that I had with Bitcoin, until I figured out that its use value is its transfer function. Bitcoin allows you to cross borders easily and cheaply with all of your wealth. And that's the problem with gold. As good as gold is for money with those five characteristics I mentioned, that's the big plus with Bitcoin. And in today's highly regulated world, where the government can slap on foreign exchange controls and tell you you can't leave the country, Bitcoin is a godsend. So in today's world, yes, do save in Bitcoin as well as gold. And there are good reasons to believe why Bitcoin, which is now, let's say $60,000, is going to go much higher. Because all of these governments around the world, all of them, are printing up their fiat currencies like sheets of toilet paper. So where are you going to hide? You can speculate in real estate, speculate in stocks, speculate in things. But what you want to do is have a place where you can put aside capital and it's liquid and it'll be there. And gold is great. But now Bitcoin in today's world, I think, makes a lot of sense too. So I'm bullish on both.
Mm. So then you said before about good currency. In the light of what's gone on in recent years, is the US dollar still a good currency?
No, it's not. It's a floating abstraction. It's a fiat certificate issued by a bankrupt government. And the US government is in fact bankrupt. They're in the US, they're printing up trillions of dollars to finance the U.S. government at this point. You know, it used to be in the U.S., they said, don't worry about borrowing some money. We owe it to ourselves. But now Americans don't buy that debt. Then they said, don't worry about it. Those nice Chinese and Japanese will buy it. But they're trying to offload all their dollars. They realize that they're basically hot potatoes. So where's the government, which is running these huge deficits, because they can't tax much more without breaking the back of the economy? They're printing up dollars. That's what the Federal Reserve does, and giving them to the U.S. government, and the U.S. government then allocates it to its favorite classes. So that's the basic argument for buying gold and Bitcoin. And of course, you can also say that Bitcoin is a harder currency than gold, harder in the view that there's less of it being created. There's a fixed, absolutely fixed amount that can never be exceeded of Bitcoin. And that's kind of true of gold. It gets harder to mine every year. Costs go up and there's less gold underground. Yeah, you need both of them. Look, it's a way of defending yourself from the state. The state is not your friend.
No. So then I look at, just going back to the cultural element. So you look at the US that from a cultural perspective, and I'm talking about the cultural element that I work in and live in, which is this sort of whole postmodernist destruction of the West. You look at that versus, say, the BRICS nations, which are now sort of up and coming, and they're talking about, I think either they're pulling together or wanting to have pulled together their own currency. And you're looking at a collection of nations which are made up of communist socialists and totalitarians, essentially, and dictators. How does then that play out? Because is there a real risk that those nations could overtake the US dollar as the financial standard for many trading things, like particularly oil or the like?
Yeah, well, the BRICS. We're talking about Brazil, Russia, India, Iran, South Africa, and a bunch of other countries like that. And for whatever advantages that they might present in different ways, I really don't want to own a currency issued by a bunch of collectivist governments, quite frankly. So jumping out of the US dollar and jumping into the Chinese yuan or the Russian ruble, it's like jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, quite frankly. They're all the same. Look, people have forgotten the fact that before the last depression, which lasted from 1929 to 1946, the whole world used gold as money before roughly 1933. You would have gold coins in your pocket. And the dollar was just a name for a specific amount of gold. That's all changed today. So I think the world is going to go back to gold because these governments don't trust each other. I mean, look, even the Chinese and the Russians trading between each other usually use dollars. Now, that's crazy, isn't it? Why use the currency of your adversary when it has to clear through New York? Well, the whole world is priced in U.S. dollars at this point, and they don't like it. So they're trying to get away from it, and they'll dump the dollar successfully at some point in the future. Not because they're using rubles or yuan or whatever, rupees or some other paper currency. They'll dump the dollar because the dollar is owned and controlled by the U.S. And the Russians have found that if the U.S. government doesn't like you, they'll steal your money. That's what they did to the Russians. I mean, they took the private property of not just the Russian government, but Russian citizens. Now, I know a lot of people have a bee in their bonnet saying, oh, evil people, Putin, horrible dictator, and so forth. And we can get into that and talk about the hysteria against these people where you've got to create a gigantic foreign enemy for yourself. But these governments are going to have to go back to trading with gold. The world will have to go back to trading with gold because you cannot trust fiat currencies of any country. And at some point, we don't really know how many U.S. dollars are floating around outside of the U.S., but it's many, many trillions because the U.S. dollar is the largest export of the U.S. It's not Boeing's, it's not wheat, it's U.S. dollars. We send those dollars abroad and the nice Japanese accept them in exchange for Toyotas and Colombians accept them in exchange for cocaine and so forth. But these people are sitting on trillions and trillions of dollars that have no intrinsic value. And at some point, they're going to decide that these are just trading sardines on back liabilities of a bankrupt government, and they're going to start dumping them. And when that happens, there's no place that the U.S. dollar is guaranteed to be accepted, except back in the U.S., where they'll all come back to the U.S. in exchange for titles to real estate and stocks and whatever else the U.S. has. Inflation will skyrocket. We're looking at financial chaos someplace in the future, not too long in the future, I suspect. It's we're approaching the end game. Hate to sound so apocalyptic, Marie, but it's a serious situation.
No, don't sound. Believe me, I have Trevor Loudon on the show. If you can out apocalyptic Trevor, you'll be doing well. You mentioned the Great Depression, actually, 1929-1946, and I know Professor Neil Ferguson, the historian, was talking recently about how at the end of that sort of period of the Roaring Twenties, leading into the Depression, a lot of the movements into totalitarian states, you had the educated universities within Germany, and how those people within academia were the ones that were considered the best and then sort of turned things in culture and then politically, next minute, you know, you have World War II and things sort of go to hell in a handcart. I mean, as an observer, just a very casual observer of history, I'm looking at this thinking, I'm seeing a lot of deja vu here. Are we now in the 2020s at the same risks as they were in the 1920s to look down the barrel of another great global depression, which will then kick off into another world war?
Yes, we are. First thing we ought to do once again is define the word in question. And the word is depression. So what is a depression? And most people, as you indicated, say, well, isn't that kind of what happened back in 1929 and during the 30s and 40s? Yeah, it is kind of, but let's give it a definition. And the best broad general definition of a depression is it's a period of time when most people's standard of living drops significantly. And this is actually the significance of all the debt that's in the world today. The world is head over heels in debt. And when you have debt, it means that you're one of two things is happening. Either you're borrowing capital that other people have created and saved in the past, or you're mortgaging your future to pay it back. So It's a bad thing, it's a dangerous thing, and if the financial merry-go-round slows down and some people can't pay their debt, well, the next guy can't pay his debt, and the next guy, and the next guy, and it can all come tumbling down. And of course, in today's highly regulated, governmentalized, politicized world, everybody will go to their governments and say, do something. Well, there's really not much the government can do, except print more money. That's the source of the problem. It's not a solution. So, yes, I think a depression, a nasty depression, is inevitable. Another definition of a depression, which might make sense to, I think, a lot of people, is it's a period of time when distortions and misallocations of capital in the economy are liquidated. This is where somebody might because it seems like there's a financial boom going on, somebody might borrow $1 million from a bank to start a business catering to a fad. Business goes bankrupt. What happened to that $1 million? Well, the bank loses it, which in a sound banking system would mean that the depositors of the bank lose it. Well, of course, the government bails it out today and the value of the currency goes down further. But we're in for some very, very tough times in the years to come. And of course, the last depression wound up with World War II. And this depression may well wind up in World War III. One of the reasons why war follows economic collapse is because governments like to blame somebody else for their problems or create problems abroad to distract people from the economic situation. Those are two good reasons why wars happen. And I think this thing in the Ukraine could still spin out of control, not to mention the thing between the Israelis and the Arabs, or the Muslims, really, both. That could spin out of control. China's got looking at real problems at this point. We don't know if Mr. Xi might decide, idiotically, in my opinion, to conquer Taiwan, to give the Chinese people something to unite them where they're fighting a foreign enemy. I think war is a pretty sure thing in the near future. Certainly, in the United States, we have this election coming up in November, which is, well, I think it could be the most hotly contested election since that that put Abraham Lincoln in office. No matter who wins, whether it's the Democrats and Biden, I'm not even sure he's going to be around long enough to run. I think they're going to replace him with somebody else, but that's conjecture on my part. Between the Democrats and Trump, I think there's an excellent chance the Democrats might foment a real war. It's just a little sport war. The U.S. has had lots of sport wars, something more serious to unite the people. So they don't want to change horses in the middle of the stream, because the people running the U.S. are actually Jacobins. And now that they have control of the apparatus of the state, they don't want to let it go. I'm serious. And they hate the Trumpers, and the Trumpers hate them. And the country's divided about 50-50. So this is really serious.
Yeah, well, actually, Trevor, you've just pretty much reflected what Trevor said here a few weeks ago. And he predicts that there will be some sort of unrest, whether that be civil unrest at home or something else abroad, where, exactly as you said, they don't want to upset the apple cart and maintain governance there. Or his sort of wonder is whether or not they will do something where the current administration enact emergency powers to keep themselves, to prevent an election, or they do some form of attack if they lose and they manage not to rig things as they seem to have done last time, potentially, or allegedly, that they use the lame duck period to launch something.
And not only that, if things get serious economically or socially, with lots of riots and that, the people will go to the government, ask them to do something. And this is where you get a man riding a white horse that says, give me enough power and I'll straighten everything out. And then you're in for real trouble.
Mm. So then let's look at that, because you're in Argentina and I've just spent some time there. And I spoke to a lot of people because I've been there a few times before. And I found that most Argentinians fell into three camps. They thought Milei was the greatest thing that they've seen in Argentinian politics for decades. There were those that hated the predecessor and would vote for anybody that stood against him. And then there were the third group that were pretty unhappy about what Milei was doing, because they essentially had some ties to the public service and they were losing their jobs, or they were Patagonians, depending on where you were. The Patagonians weren't quite so enamored with him. The further away from Buenos Aires you got, they seemed a little less enamored.
Well, the Kirchners came from Patagonia, actually one of the provinces down there. That's right. The Milei phenomenon is, in my opinion, the biggest and best thing that's happened in world politics forever. And why do I say that? Because he overtly announced the fact that he's an anarcho-capitalist. That means he believes in a total free market. He believes in free minds as well as free markets. He doesn't want to see regulations, taxes, inflation, none of this nonsense. And he basically wants to pull the government out by its roots and sow Agent Orange where it grew. He was elected by, I think the number was 56-58% of the people. Most of the younger people voted for him because they were fed up with a society which is, Argentina is full of what we call gnocchis. Gnocchis are those little pasta balls that they just sit there on your plate inert. And he's already fired many thousands of government employees that don't even go to work. And actually, that's better than they're going to work, because if they go to work and do what they're told, they'll just make people's lives more miserable. And his plans, he's just announced that he's looking to fire 70,000 more of them. They can go out and do something productive with their lives.
So I think it's absolutely marvelous. And the amount of inflation, Argentina is famous for destroying the peso. I mean, it's destroyed, I think, five currencies, taken them to zero since 1930 when it went off of gold.
Well, it's cheaper to light your fire with pesos than it is with the local newspaper.
Oh, it's shocking. I mean, look, I wish I could show you a stack of the things. When I go out and I'm going to buy something for cash, I have to take a wad of pesos about 2 inches thick.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
that's
insane.
inconvenient, frankly. But that's the way it is down here. But inflation, he wants to get rid of the central bank, something that New Zealand should do as well. They should get rid of the Reserve Bank. It serves no useful purpose
Will he
as
be
well.
able to, because he's looking at introducing the US dollar? I mean, it's the look, to be honest, it is the dominant currency there anyway. If you're there with US dollars, you can go anywhere, do anything, buy anything.
That's
But
true.
is yeah, it, but it's he's looking to formalize that arrangement, which I think is it the Ecuadorians that have they're on the US dollar as well? I mean, will he be able to do
Well,
that?
there are several countries in the world that use the US dollar that don't have a national currency. Liberia is one. Ecuador uses is dollarized and uses the US dollar. Panama uses the US dollar as well. I think those are the only three that are dollarized. Okay, that's better. You're jumping out of the fire into the frying pan. Anyway, it's more comfortable in a frying pan than a fire. So yeah, that's good. But what Milei has said and is doing is you can use anything for a currency, anything between two consenting adults, whether we're talking socially or economically, is fine with Milei. And that makes sense to me. And the rate of retail price increases has fallen tremendously just in the 100 days that he's been in here. It's gone from 30% per month to 25% per month. Now it's down to 13%. These are government figures, and you can't trust government figures, certainly not Argentine government figures, but they're indicative, and inflation rates are dropping. So, yeah, he's going to be successful. But the important thing is, although most people didn't pay attention to it, perhaps, or don't believe it, he's an anarcho-capitalist, which means that he doesn't believe in the government as an institution, and he's sincere about it. I really wish him well, and I support him every way possible.
So do you think that that will, if he's successful, do you think that that will paint a target on his back? Because other large nations will not want him to succeed.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And the kind of people that go into government are capable of anything. I mean, look, you got two types of people in the world. People that like to create things and act in the real world. And then you got people that like to control other people. That's how they get ahead. And that second type of person are the type that go into government. Actually, it takes a criminal mentality, in my opinion, to go into government and want to navigate in those waters. So to answer your question, will somebody try to bump him off? It's possible. Yes, it's possible. Just as if Trump is elected, and Trump is no libertarian, don't get me wrong, he's a huge improvement over the Bidenistas, but he's no libertarian. But these people hate him so much, they might try to bump him off as well. These are just a couple of the reasons I'm looking at chaos for the rest of this decade, quite frankly.
Well, the thing that's just happened very recently here, and I know that it affected the United States and the United Kingdom, is that it was discovered a Chinese hacking scandal that the Chinese managed to get through many layers of government in all three, and it happened here, UK, USA. It was a huge news story here, and literally, I mean, Judith Collins, who is now, you may remember her from your time in New Zealand, she's now the Attorney General. And she was very grim-faced when she announced this, but in reality, they're out. Biggest trading partner. We have a lot of steam buns in that basket. And so nothing can be done. So you look at that and I think, are we looking to, I mean, as New Zealanders, I mean, as the threat, do we need to look northwest to that threat?
Yeah, right. Well, of course, the demographics of New Zealand have changed rather radically over the last couple of generations. Well, look, my view, and I think the view of most libertarians towards foreign powers, is you should be friendly to everybody, but allied to nobody, because alliances entangle and can only get you into trouble. And you think that the New Zealanders, more than anybody else, would recognize that, you know, being used as cannon fodder during World War I, frankly, and defending the British monarchy.
Well, it's a case of, I think, we get, the Five Eyes gets more out of us than we get out of it.
Oh, I think so. Look, New Zealand just ought to mind its own business and concentrate on being prosperous, not be hooked up with these, you know, terrible predatory spook powers, the CIA and the rest of these horrible Praetorian agencies that we have in the U.S. And the British are just as bad. Australians, well, in Canada, I mean, Canada's turning into a police state, quite frankly, where you can be fined and imprisoned for saying things that they don't like. I mean, this is unheard of in a Western country, that you can't even speak your mind. You dare not, or the government might land on you. I mean, this is brand new. So no, New Zealand doesn't need an association with these, the rest of the Five Eyes.
So we've
That's
got
not
a new
bureaucracy that could be gotten rid of immediately. And the people that work for it can find gainful employment, hopefully.
So the coalition government that's barely been, they've only really just got their feet under the desk, but they've had their first 100 days. What are some of the things that you would like to think that they should do that would actually help get, as Christopher Luxon is fond of saying, back on track?
Well, it's not a question of what the government should do. It's a question of what it shouldn't do, that they should stop. If you look at what the nature of government is coercion, it's force. Like Mao Tse-tung said, it comes out of the barrel of a gun. And if that's the case, if you want a civil society, you want to limit the power of government. You want to limit institutionalized coercion. That means the government should have police to protect you, keep you from violence domestically, should have a small military, or perhaps all the citizens kind of militiaized to protect you from foreign troublemakers, and a court system to allow you to adjudicate disputes without resorting to force. So that means that every government agency, almost all of them, should be abolished. They serve no useful purpose. Or let me put it this way. If they serve a useful purpose, the free market could provide whatever they provide much cheaper and much faster and much better. And all those government employees working for God knows how many agencies there are, they could, if what they do is worthwhile, they could find employment in the private sector.
Well, on that note, that's actually very pertinent because, of course, they are slashing jobs here. And the wah, wah, wah from the public sector and the media are about the 7.5% in savings that they need to find. And I think when the budget is announced in May, that number will become even larger. So, you know, it's good to hear that sometimes common sense needs to prevail. And I think common sense has left the room for quite some time, and it's now time for it to re-enter the conversation.
Well, that's right. It's time that people stop relying on the nanny state. And if the parasites working for government complain, well, of course they complain. I mean, when a dog gets a bath, the fleas complain about being washed off the dog. So it's the same thing. Yeah. Mm.
Hey, look, Doug, if people want to find out or find more from your readings or some of the stuff that you publish, where can they find you?
Well, it's pretty easy. I have a YouTube channel. It's called Doug Casey's Take. That's one. On the internet, internationalman.com, we do lots of really good articles every day. So it's free. So subscribe there. And if A lot of people don't know that I've written a series of novels. Yes, tracing the history of a great hero named Charles Knight as he goes through seven unjustly besmirched occupations. And when he's a kid, he starts out as a speculator and winds up in a bush war in Africa. So that's a pretty exciting book, talking about speculation as an occupation and how you can be a good guy while you're a speculator. Then he becomes a drug lord, and people say, drug lord, no, that's horrible. But he's a good guy, drug lord, and we explain how. Then, after the government does bad things to him, he becomes an assassin. We show that an assassin can be a good guy. And there are four more that get more radical after that. But start with those three.
Okay.
You can get them from Amazon and anywhere. But they're good reads, I promise you.
Oh, look, there you go. Do love me a good book, Doug. So thank you so much for that. This has been Doug.
You'll like these.
This is Doug Casey, International Man, here in Counterculture. Don't disappear. My mate Marty is here next with Media Matters here on Reality Check Radio. Thanks, Doug.
Thanks, Marie. It's been a pleasure.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.